Hey, nurses! This National Nurses Week 2025, it's time to celebrate you, the backbone of healthcare, with a vacation you truly deserve. Join Nurse.com for a luxurious group cruise aboard Virgin Voyages, sailing May 9th through May 14th. It's a celebration like never before, designed exclusively for nurses. Picture this. Tranquil ocean views, world-class amenities, and the chance to connect with your nursing community while leaving the stress of long shifts far behind. Plus, when you join us, you'll receive $200 in onboard credit per cabin to enjoy spa treatments, premium excursions, merchandise, and more. You spend every day caring for others. Now it's your turn. Let's trade scrubs for sandals and sail into National Nurses Week with joy, connection, and well-deserved relaxation. Register now to join the group trip at nurse.com/cruise. That's nurse.com/cruise. We can't wait to celebrate you. Hey, nurses. Welcome to the Nurse Dot Podcast, giving nurses validation, resources, and hope one episode at a time. Today on Nurse Dot Podcast.
They coach survivors and encourage them to share their story because it's not only helping them, it's helping others who believe I'm alone. You're not alone. You are not alone. To think with all the thousands that stood up and say, me too, including me, think of the thousands that still remain.
Joining us today, Marie McKenzie, with over 2.5 decades of experience as a registered nurse, including her role as a sexual assault nurse examiner in the clinical and community settings. Marie blends her professional expertise with the tools and techniques that facilitated her own healing journey. I'm your host, Kara Lunsford, registered nurse and VP of community at nurse.com. Okay, Marie McKenzie. Now we're going to formally kick this thing off.
Yay!
Okay, so you're a nurse.com ambassador, which is also very exciting to have you on the podcast. But I'm really excited to have you on because, like I was saying, we just interviewed Dr. Anne Burgess. She is this amazing, incredible woman who helped with profiling and for serial killers and rapists. And in the 1970s, like with the FBI, when it was not popular for women to be in the room.
Right.
And to this day, she is like literally responsible for changing the way law enforcement actually saw rape.
Wow.
And the way the FBI saw rape, she changed the whole idea around it not being about sex.
Right.
And getting away from the victim blaming, where it was like, well, she was asking for it or she was wearing this and that. And what was she doing out without her husband? And God knows any other thing that somebody might say, right? But she actually was really responsible for changing all of that during like the early 1970s.
Wow, we need more of her.
Oh my gosh, I know, right? Exactly. All right, so Marie, tell us a little bit about, just tell us a little bit about yourself, some bio, and just how you got into this area of nursing, and then we'll kind of get into all of it.
Yeah, so as you said, I'm Marie McKenzie, and I'm a nurse ambassador for the nurse.com. I grew up in Jamaica, where my role model, my aunt Irma, was a nurse when I was growing up. So I spent a lot of hours with her in the hospital in Kingston, seeing the way she cared for and interacted with her patients. And ever since I was a child, that's the only career I wanted. I wanted to be a nurse. So this didn't materialize for me until I migrated to the United States. And I walked out of nursing school straight into the emergency room. Little did I know life experience and my chosen career would set me up with an answer that I had to, a call that I had to answer. So while working in the emergency room, I got the opportunity to work with sexual assault victims. Now, back then when I started, the doctors would be the one who collect the evidence. The nurse would package and, you know, maintain chain of custody. So many years later, since 2014, I've been a trained SANE. So now I independently interview victims, collect the evidence and maintain chain of custody until law enforcement, you know, picks it up. Now, as a SANE or registered nurses specially trained to care for victims of sexual assault. You know, as nurses, we were trained in interview, assessment, documentation. So all those transitional skills we take to this specially highly trained avenue of nursing. So the TLC, whatever the survivor needs, getting them comfortable with the interview. And they are the one who sets the pace for this interview. There is no rush or interrogation where we are concerned. And it's reporting is up to them as long as they are above 18 years old. But we encourage victims, whether they want to report or not, to get the rape kit, the sexual assault evidence kit. Because later on, if they change their mind, at least the evidence will be there. Like now in Florida, the evidence for unreported cases kept up to 50 years. So, yes. So we'll have the DNA evidence if the victim decides to go to court. So there is a lot of having fun working with the multidisciplinary team, the sexual assault response team, which are healthcare providers, victim advocates, the crime lab. It's amazing. Well, amazing work, not, you know, the victims have to go through. But I love that there are people like us and the team that are there for victim because they need the support to get justice, heal, thrive, and survive. So my experience has been in the emergency room, plus with the Rape Crisis Center in the community. And that works differently with how they operate. Yeah. So say, for example, in the emergency room, the victim comes in, they're greeted, if they walk in, then they're greeted by someone in triage, or if they come by ambulance and they come back. We always have an assigned room. Sometimes if there's no SANE on duty, then there'll be one on call. So then that person will be called to come in. Plus we call the victim's advocate who's there for the victim. If law enforcement was not informed ahead of time, then and the victim wants to report, or is a child or an elderly abuse case, then of course we call law enforcement. First, it may be a patrol officer that comes to get basic information, and then a detective is called. Versus in the Community Rape Crisis Center, I am affiliated with Victim Service Center of Central Florida, of Central Florida, where our advocates or master's prepared social workers. So they're the one who does they answer the phone, does a preliminary interview, and then call one of the SANEs. We have two SANEs on call 24/7 for victim services. So, and then we go in and we're the one who does our part of the interview, collect the kit and medication if that's indicated. First, we make sure there is no medical needs that need to be attended to, because of course that takes precedence over getting the rape kit done. And then we proceed from there. There's a timely examination that's done at the victim space. As I said, there's no rush or anything. So.
Wow. How long has it been that you could expect to have a SANE nurse, a practitioner in the hospital or in the emergency or on call? Is this something that is all throughout? It's required at every hospital?
No, every hospital has a SANE program. Unfortunately, this is such a, there's such a need out there. Even for the programs that have SANEs, they are short-staffed. This has been just a few years since SANE came into existence. Yes.
Now, oftentimes when you're working, you do hold this certification. Are you working like in the emergency room with patients and then all of a sudden you get pulled away to do something like this? Or are you there just to do sexual assault?
When I worked in the hospital as a SANE, if I'm on shift, then I'm pulled away. If I'm on call, then I come in just for that patient.
Okay.
Whereas for the Rape Crisis Center, then we're only there for that one person.
Okay. That makes sense. And then in a Rape Crisis Center, how much can you do to assess someone's physical needs? Like, how much are you capable of doing before you'd have to send them to an emergency room? Like, if someone came to the center, like, at what point do you just triage and say, like, okay, this is someone who has to be, like, we have to escalate this care?
Well, the advocates would have already identified an emergency, unless that's something where the forensic evidence is and it's not visible or they didn't get a report. But usually they determine that before they even call us, that person's going to the hospital. Because there are times when we go to the hospital to do the kit because the survivor is not able to be discharged.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm. So you can come in almost as a contractor.
Through victim services, yes.
Hospital
doesn't have a SANE.
Okay.
Yes.
That makes sense. And do all of the, sorry, I'm trying to understand this whole process because it's so important for nurses to understand the role that they can play and in what setting.
Yes.
That they can do this. So
absolutely.
If they're working for Rape Crisis Center, can they pretty much go in? Do they have the ability to go into any hospital, or do they have to already be kind of contracted with that hospital?
Yes, they have to have a relationship with that hospital.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Got it. That it's so good to understand because we know that resources within the hospital systems can be very strained.
Yes.
And I think it's so important for people to understand whether or not you are a survivor of sexual assault and you need to know where you can go versus if you're a nurse and you want to work in this area. I think it's also really important to understand the differences and what to expect from each setting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've been doing that for 10 years? For the last
10 years? Yes. And what I want nurses to know, the training is free. The Florida Council Against Sexual Violence provides a 40-hour training. Then you go and do your clinicals. That's clinical training too. Then you get checked off. I was fortunate. I was able to be precepted by the physicians in the emergency room. Some nurses would go to the OBGYN to do a certain amount of speculum examination and be checked off for that. You don't have to be certified. There is a national certification that you can do. But most nurses are trained for as long as they do this part of their profession. Yes.
It must be really difficult, I imagine. And I did want to ask really quickly, because I know that there's always changes in language, right? Some people find it offensive to call them a victim. Other people say, I want to be referred to as a survivor.
Survivor, yes.
Yeah. Is there an appropriate terminology to be using, or is it really just depends on the person?
It all depends. And I struggle with using the word victim. If there's a word I could ban, it would be victim, because it sort of fosters hopelessness and powerlessness, not taking into consideration resilience and things like that, you know. So when you get rid of that word and use like survivor, it gives hope, you know, meaning that you can overcome, you can survive and thrive. You know, it's like there's one word I could get rid of, it would be victim.
Yeah, and maybe victim is used when someone doesn't survive. I mean, if someone was a victim of sexual assault and we kind of know that they didn't survive it, it's like, well, then they were right. in fact a victim of sexual assault or violence or something to that effect. And mm-hmm. and I don't know. I guess it's always for us to try and decide how we want to frame things. But I agree with you. I tend to lean more towards the survivor, especially if they are still alive.
Yes.
Because I agree with you. I feel like highlighting the fact that they were able to overcome or to be strong enough to get through that, or I definitely can see the difference.
Yeah. So, it's like the victim is keeping them just to that experience. And they're more than that.
Yes.
They're more than the experience. Something that wasn't their fault. Right.
Yes.
Right. Something that wasn't their fault. So
we
don't
want
them to remain victims. And I also find that when you're traumatized, multiple people may experience the same event and some are traumatized while others are not. So it all depends on what coping skills may be there ahead of time.
Yeah.
You know, what your previous experiences were. So that also affects how you handle whatever the situation is.
I think that that's a really good point. And I'd love for you to highlight a little bit, because one of the things that I think is really interesting is around unconscious bias. And I think sometimes we are biased in a variety of ways, whether it be ethnically, racially, religious bias, all kinds of different biases, right? Gender. But we also, I think, can sometimes be biased by how someone responds to an event. So if you see that the person is not dealing with it the way you would expect to deal with it, where you look at them and you say, well, they don't seem very traumatized by this.
Right.
I would be so traumatized. And then are you questioning whether are they telling the truth and did this really happen? And because we start to judge, we judge people based on how they respond to things. But you made a really good point just now about people respond differently.
Yes.
Based on their own experiences and coping mechanisms.
Yes. That's absolutely true. And I've seen that. There's one story that I heard about these two girls that were walking by a mental asylum. And one of the residents there flashed his genitalia. And one was completely traumatized, while the other one was like, oh, that's nothing. Because she had grew up where that was like common occurrence. So, yes, what's traumatized one person? So if you've developed the coping skills, or if that's something that you have dealt with before, you may not be traumatized. You may be affected, but not traumatized.
Yeah, because I think desensitization to some extent, it's we're just products of our own experiences. And sometimes we can be very desensitized to things that we otherwise really shouldn't be. We shouldn't be desensitized to those things.
Yes.
It should be shocking. It should be traumatizing.
It should be.
And maybe at one point in our lives when we were much younger, when it happened the first time, maybe it was more traumatizing.
Yes. And then because of repeated, I was going to talk about that too, because of the repeated trauma, you have developed like a numbness just to get through it, to cope with it. So you're not crying anymore, you know, and it's almost like you're pleasing the perpetrator just to get it over with.
Yes.
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 But then it's until the next time, because, you know, for victims who don't have a voice, they may not be believed. They may not be in an environment where they can go share it with someone. To see self-blame, shame, guilt for whatever reason, because you're not the perpetrator, those things thrive in secrecy. So you keep that. And then, you know, when you think of the compound effect, something like that has on a victim, especially a child, straight through to adulthood.
Yes. You know,
yes.
So
devastating.
So tell me, take me through kind of a day. I'm a survivor of sexual assault. I've just had an unwanted sexual experience, and we'll just say rape.
Right.
Can you walk me through a little bit of like your process, like what your process would be like, just sitting down with me and talking to me, like if you were going to talk to me as a survivor of sexual assault, how would you start?
Okay. First, developing rapport, making sure you're comfortable. Are you in any pain? You know, making sure.
I am. I'm in a lot of pain.
Okay.
I'm in a lot of physical pain, and I'm in a lot of emotional pain.
Emotional pain. So we are addressing that. I'm getting your history, wanting to know, do you have allergies? There's medication that we can offer, because I want you to be comfortable. So I'm sitting with you eye to eye, and we are having a conversation. I'm going to see if there are any injuries that needs medical care. If I'm in the emergency room, the physician is right there. If I'm at the rape crisis center, then I have to get you to the hospital.
I have some bruises. I have bruises on me that I can see, but I don't think I'm bleeding.
Okay, so then you're staying with me. So I'm getting your history, making sure you don't have allergies, and getting you some pain medication to be comfortable. And then when we are ready, I'm getting you on, you get into a gown. We're collecting clothing as evidence. The interview is to gather information about what happened, which guides where we collect evidence. We get forensic evidence from, like, one lady told me he kissed me on the neck. Then I'd swab the neck and, yes, and his DNA was found. Of course, he went to jail because that's the only place they found his DNA.
Wow.
He raped her, but that was the only place they found his DNA. But he said he never touched her. So, yes, you have some explaining to do. So we call it the clothing, and we get consent. And getting consent in the beginning, that doesn't mean you have to go through the process. Whenever you feel like stopping, it's all up to you. If you want to do the rape kit, the sexual assault evidence kit, it's up to you if you want to stop it anywhere. I would educate you on the importance of having the kit done, whether you want to report at the time or not. We have 5 days, 120 hours, where evidence-based practice has found that that's the best time to get evidence, early as possible. But beyond 5 days, we may not find anything. So I go through all that with you, get consent, you get changed, and we start the process. I do interview, get head-to-toe assessment. We are documenting, we are collecting swabs, we're taking pictures. And all that goes to the crime lab, the law enforcement. So, and I disclose that to you because I don't want you to think, okay, we keep everything there at the hospital or the rape crisis center. We don't keep any of the, we keep medical records. So that will be copies of the interviews, but like the swabs and everything goes out with law enforcement. The hospital or rape crisis center has up to 30 days to pass it on to law enforcement. of course, we don't keep it that long. It's gone by the same day or the following day in most cases. Then for non-reports, it's the patient's identification is not anywhere on where law enforcement can see it. So until they determine later that they want to report, otherwise they don't know.
Are now, they just given like a case number or something like that?
It gets a number, yes.
So that they can come back and say, this is my case number if they want to.
Yes. A beautiful thing we have now over the last few years is what's called a track kit. There is a special QR code that they are given, and they can track their kits through the system now. Yes, they can track their kits to whether the reports or the non-reports will get that.
Wow.
And they keep that for themselves, yes. So when we offer new clothing at the Rape Crisis Center, we have fresh, brand new clothing for them to take a shower. We offer them something to eat. Maybe we have medications for STD prophylaxis, pregnancy prevention, for pain. And our advocates is there. One very important thing, whether you're at the hospital or the Rape Crisis Center, there's an advocate for the survivor. So at the hospital, we don't do the kit until the advocate gets there, because they're there just for to hold their hands or whatever comfort they need. A case I had in 2017 was a young girl, and it didn't go to trial until last year. She was my only child victim, and it stayed with me all these years. And I was so excited when I went. She had the same advocate from 2017. The same advocate, and they had grown very close. She, you know, she was there for her, and I was so excited to see her. I know this is going off on a tangent.
No,
but
it's great.
I never forgot her, and I always wondered what happened to her. And when the DA called me, you know, to tell me the case is coming up and everything, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. I always wonder about her. And he said, you have? And I said, yes. And he said, why? And I was telling him how, you know, it touched me. You just wish you could take her home. It broke my heart, and I could. I went to court. Part of what saints do, we testify in court. And of course, the defense attorney will try to discredit you, because the one I had in my last case, man, she went after me. And the more she yelled and did her thing, the more comfortable I became. I don't know how or what, but she just couldn't rattle me. One of the things they'll try to, because a lot of times victims will, the survivors remember different pieces of the incident at different times. So they may say something to me different or tell more to the police. So in this case, I'd ask her about strangulation and she said no. But then when she got to the police, she said something about the hand around her neck. And it was like, oh, she was lying. So I had to explain to her. And I'm sure she knew, if you're a defense attorney for a perpetrator of rape, you should do your research enough to know that victims sometimes don't tell all the story. Some never tell all the story. And sometimes they remember it in pieces. So, and I just got comfortable understand. And he got life.
Wow.
There was a jury. There was only one woman on the jury, all male. And he got life. So I was very excited. He wasn't sentenced the same day. It was like months later, but he got life. So I digress. So where were we?
What I love about the podcast is I love how the stories unfold.
Yes.
You know, and that's why conversation is so important, because, and I try not to keep things very rigid, because sometimes something's going to just come up for you.
Yes.
And you're just going to want to share it. And
yes,
it's going to be this piece of gold for the listeners and the audience. And they're going to say, I want to be part of that.
Yes.
I want to do that. I want to, you know, help put somebody away for life.
Yes.
And that's very powerful.
Yes. And I found that sharing your story is powerful. I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. I was muted for all my childhood. I wasn't threatened. I just never told. It happened. I don't know if you've read my memoir. It happened in a house with other people.
The things that keep me up at night.
Yes. Oh, you remember? Yes. It happened in a house with people. I never told them then. I was in my 40s before I told my aunt for the first time. She died before I went public. And when it came out, so many friends and even family members who came forward to share their own story, because it was like, oh, if Marie can share, then I can share. People who had remained muted. And the guilt, shame, self-blame that paralyzes you for most of your life. You are blaming yourself for something that's not your fault. So after that was released and I continued to share my story and see how much it has helped others to start healing and thriving. And I'm now a sexual and intimacy and relationship coach. And I do coach survivors and encourage them to share their story, because it's not only helping them, it's helping others who believe, I'm alone. You're not alone. You are not alone.
And that was Me Too, right? That was the Me Too movement.
The Me Too movement. And to think, with all the thousands that stood up and say Me Too, including me, think of the thousands that still remain muted for one reason or another. So yes. The stories are powerful. I love to encourage people to share their story.
Mental health matters. Become a master's prepared psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Nightingale College. If you are an RN with a bachelor's degree in nursing, you can take the next step in a rewarding career move where you'll develop advanced knowledge and skills in assessment, intervention, and management within the construct of the psychiatric mental health patient-provider relationship and patient-centered care across the lifespan. This CCNE accredited program is now taking applications for the fall 2025 semester. For more information, please visit nightingale.edu or call 801-689-2160, because mental health matters. Yeah. And I wonder if sometimes, because I imagine sometimes I try to put myself in the listener's shoes, or, mm-hmm. or even just as someone who has had my own experiences, I think to myself, oh gosh, I'd love to be able to do this. I'd love to be able to be a sane practitioner, and I would love to be able to work for the crisis center. I would love to be, I'm not sure if it would be too triggering. Maybe I can't do it. I'm not sure if I could do it. Like,
and some can't. Some people can't at all, because I've had cases that stays with me, you know, as I told you, from 2017, and I can still see the 14-year-old girl in the bed. I know every word of the interview. I know some do not leave you. So you have to develop coping skills. You have to develop your self-care packets. You have a self-care packet that you're going to go pull out of. Otherwise, you get lost.
Yes. And you know, it was interesting, because when I was interviewing Ann Burgess, I said, how do you deal with all that? Like, how do you see all of that darkness and really terrible things? And one of the things that she said to me is, she said, I feel like as nurses, we are just so well positioned to do this type of work, because we do see so much, we do experience so much, and we have learned how to compartmentalize in a lot of ways, and how to try and, yes, be in touch with our feelings, but not in the moment, to kind of put a pin in it and deal with it later.
Not in the moment.
Yeah, not in the moment, but deal with it later. And I definitely appreciate the fact that sometimes when you can be on the other side of something, it can have its own catharsis.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Has it been like that for you? Do you find that you've had your healing through this work?
Yes. Yes, it's cathartic. Someone had asked me one time, and I said, it's like providing what I didn't seek for myself or received. Yes.
Yes. Like watching someone get a life sentence.
Yes. Oh, dear Jesus. Yes. Or just being there for the survivor in the emergency room. I'm so glad that I was trained and I can perform this independently, because I've worked with physicians, and I'm going to say this on air. I once was doing it. Oh my God, it's so heartbreaking. The doctor was performing the exam and he shoved the speculum.
He what?
He shoved the speculum.
Like shoved it?
Shoved the speculum. It's like, I don't want to do this. Yes. It broke my heart, because this is someone who was just traumatized. And here you are. Yes.
Oh my.
Yes. And it's been a lot of years. And there are things you don't remember. And that was one of the saddest moments of my nursing career, watching a physician do that.
And
a rape victim.
And what? How did they respond?
She didn't. She didn't flinch or anything. But I flinched. I don't know if she realized what happened, but I saw, and I felt it. I still feel it.
So when you're doing that kind of pelvic exam, what do you do? Like, what's the process? Like, what's the, you know, talking to the...
You communicate every step of the way. I'm going to touch you here. I'm going to insert the speculum now. I'm going to do this. Every step of the way you're communicating, you're telling them everything. Yes. Yes.
And with this
there is no surprise move. Yeah, no surprise move. And you're going as quickly as you can and as gently as you can, because you want it to, that part to be over quickly.
Yes.
But yes.
Of course. Oh, it's that's got to be so, so difficult. So like you said, the ability to now do this autonomously.
Yes. From someone who really wants to be there for survivors.
So, yes.
I had one experience where one did not want me for her nurse. I walked into the room and she said, I don't want you for my nurse. So, yes, it was in the emergency room. And she said, I don't want you for my nurse. And I went back and I told the charge nurse, and she said, I'm not reassigning you. Now, I was the only sane, and I was the only one who wanted to care for her. And I went back and I explained to her, you know, the charge nurse is not going to reassign you. And she said, okay. I mean, she probably thought she didn't have a choice. I didn't think that was an appropriate decision on the charge nurse's part. It was like victimizing the victim again. But went, I took care of her, and she was so happy. Yes, she was very, very happy and thankful. I never asked her why she didn't want me to be her nurse. That was not important to me. I could remind her of her perpetrator, who knows, you know, so, or another sad time in her life or something. I don't know what it was, but it was not important to me. I went back and I gave her the best compassionate care, and she was happy. So
I think that's such a great example of how we oftentimes have to put our own
Yes, it's not about me. Yeah, we have to put
our own ego aside and say, I don't know what's triggering this person. And you have to be, I think, probably have a good enough confidence and self-esteem to say, this person doesn't even know me. It's not personal.
It's not personal. Yes.
Even if it feels personal. but, you know, I think like what you've really been able to describe, even in this podcast episode today, is, you know, what is this specialty that nurses can explore, especially if it's something that is really something that they're passionate in, or they just want to have this extra set of skills. Mm-hmm. Now, I have another question. I'm assuming, and this is going to maybe sound biased, but how many sane practitioners are men?
Not many. I've never seen, common? I've never worked with one, but I've heard there are a few, but I would like to see more. They always say, I'd like to see more.
Well, yeah, I think that there's, I can understand how it might be triggering, mm-hmm. right?
Especially for females.
Especially for a female. Now, mm-hmm. maybe not so much for a male or maybe more so for a male. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but remember, perpetrators are female and male.
Yes.
Yes. We don't talk about the female perpetrators much, but they're out there more than you may think.
How do they typically get, what's the profile usually of a female perpetrator? is it oftentimes like a parent, a mom?
A parent, a mom? Yes, just like the male, their parents, extended family, siblings, clergy, and the school. Yeah. 85% to 90% of perpetrators are known by the victims. Yes, from parents to siblings to churches, schools, neighbors.
Yeah.
So just a minimum, it's stranger.
And is there a percentage generally between male and female perpetrators? Like, I mean, I think we kind of know that there's been historically more male perpetrators.
Yeah, so it's more men perpetrators. Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that you probably have very similar theories to what I or not just theories, but what's based in a lot of research is mm-hmm. that it's a power. It's a power thing.
Yes, it's not about sex. It's control. You know, don't believe in getting consent. It's like, I see that and I want it. You know, I got to have it. Yes. It's just control.
Control,
nothing
yeah.
to do with
and
sex.
Power. Yeah. Just a powerful. Yeah. And it's really interesting because I'm really fascinated by sociology. I know I've said this before on the podcast that, you know, just like a study of human nature mm-hmm. is something that's really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Just, and throughout time, I was talking about this recently where they had seen a big, I guess a huge spike in these cases, these kind of sexual assault cases in like the 1970s. And then I was thinking to myself, well, you know, in the 1970s, women were kind of burning the bras, right? Like they were like asserting, they were asserting themselves in their femininity and their power and, you know, kind of fighting for their rights. And I thought, well, isn't it interesting that there was also this huge uptick in the 1970s as well? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's because of this power dynamic where it's like, oh no, they're rising up. No, you got to put them down.
Put them back down. Yes.
You got to put them back down. And how much of that has happened throughout history?
Yes. The intimate partner violences, you know, rape, husband raping their wives, you're my property, you know, yes.
Yeah. I mean, even in the 1920s during the women's suffrage, right? It's like, I wonder if there was kind of a spike seen during that time where maybe there was more of these kinds of assaults.
Probably.
Do you have children, Marie? I can't remember.
I have two stepdaughters. They're adults now.
You have two stepdaughters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't remember, but I was like, oh, I think like I had some recollection of, yeah, of adult children.
Yes. Alex and Brianna.
Are they doing anything similar? Do they do nursing? Do they do anything like that? Or what are they doing other things with their life?
Well, Alex is into mental health, and Brianna does her whole thing. Nothing healthy. She's her dad. Nothing, doesn't want anything to do with healthcare.
Nothing health related. Nothing at all. Yeah. Well, I feel like this was such a great interview, because I feel like you shed so much light on what it is to work in this field, how you cope with it, the healing that it's brought you. So the last thing I would say is, where can people go for both? Okay, so if you're a nurse and you think this is your path and you want to go this direction, which direction do they go? Where do they go?
So there's the Florida Council Against Sexual Violence. There is RAIN.org. There is the International Forensic Nursing Association. So if you Google SANE or forensic nursing, you'll get all that information there.
Okay.
Or reach out to your hospital. There are a lot of hospitals who have information on that. But your state sexual assault response team, you can get information from also.
That's
so each
perfect.
State, as like we have Florida Council Against Sexual Violence, each state has its own.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And I actually wanted to ask you another question, but I'm going to ask this one first. So then similarly, if you have survived an incident of assault, do they go to the similar places, or where would you go if you had, I mean, obviously, if you are in really bad shape, you would go to the emergency room.
Yeah, safety is number one. Yes. Call law enforcement or go to the emergency room. So you can report it at the emergency room. They have processes that they follow to get law enforcement to the hospital and get you. If they don't have a SANE program, then they know where you can go and get the appropriate care that you need.
Okay. And for anyone out there who's listening, who is worried that if they call or they ask for help, they're not going to be required to report anything.
There's no requirement to report. If you're below 18, of course, we're mandatory reporters for anyone below the age of 18, or anyone that doesn't have capacity to consent, elder abuse, or any adult that is impaired. Do you have your adults with disability? So things like that will need to report. So if you don't want to report to the police, come on in for care. There is no that you have to report to get the care that you need. We can do the kits and keep it as a non-report. In Florida, it is kept without your identification for at least 50 years. So you have time to think about it. We are able to collect the evidence up to 5 days after the rape, but we encourage you to get it done as early as possible.
Those are such great words to leave people with. And the very last thing I was going to ask you about, because I know it's such a sensitive topic and there's a lot of conversation happening, right, about women's rights. And so the question I would ask is, depending on the state that you're in, if you go to the hospital, you go to the emergency room, I think earlier you mentioned a little bit about, is it like plan B, or where you're offered maybe some sort of
pregnancy prevention prophylaxis.
Is there anything in our existing kind of laws that are preventing that from happening? Or do we know that in every state, kind of regardless of the Roe v. Wade stuff, are women all entitled to have that?
These things are different from state to state, to be amazed. So I know in Florida, we do offer it to those. Okay. There's Plan B and another one that is offered. So,
So you just kind of have to check
speak
with
for
your
every
state.
Because even dealing with rape from state to state, the laws are different.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yes.
So it's good to look into to understand your own state legislature and everything, you know, what your rights are.
Exactly. and what you can do, who to report to, and where you can get the help that you need.
Yeah,
because I mean, we want survivors to be treated respectfully and get the appropriate care that they need to start healing, thriving, and surviving.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Marie, I cannot thank you enough for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just absolutely adore you. I'm so grateful for all that you do for women and men.
Thank you.
You know, especially in the state of Florida, they're lucky to have you. And we're lucky to have you as an ambassador.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I share some tip with our young people out there?
Yes, absolutely.
And I just
please do.
Want to encourage, especially our young ladies, young college students, to practice good judgment. You know, we're not victim blaming or shaming, but practice good judgment when you're going out to bars. Go with friends. Have a designated driver. Don't accept drinks from anyone. I know there are a lot of dating apps. Please make sure you meet in a public place. Don't go back to there. You may meet someone for the first time. The date is going so well and you're invited back to his place. Not that night. Get to know that person better. I've known victims, survivors who met in a public place, felt comfortable and went back to his place and was raped that same night. If you're taking a Uber, share the location, you know, because you can share with the loved one. Like when I'm taking a Uber, I always share with my husband. You can share the license plate and it tracks you all the way home. If it's just your iPhone, share the location with a friend for the time that you are so they can find you. Have a safety plan, you know. If I text you this word, then that means I need help, you know. So, yeah, be careful. And if you're sexually assaulted, remember, it's not your fault. Go and seek help. Go and seek help. Share with someone. Don't feel guilty. Don't blame yourself. Don't feel ashamed. Don't keep silent so you can start healing right away. Get help.
Thank you so much, Marie.
What
wonderful words to end this with. And I just got chills. Like, it's just so good. I hope everyone listens to that. And because that is very, very sage wisdom right there.
Yeah, thank
so,
you.
All right. Thank you, Marie.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bye.
If you're a nurse or nursing student that enjoyed this episode, visit us at nurse.com/community,
where you can find the NurseDot discussion group, a place where we dissect each episode in detail and delve deeper into today's topics. NurseDot is a nurse.com original podcast series. Production, music, and sound editing by Dawn Lunsford. Production coordination by Rhea Wade. Additional editing by John Wells. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to the NurseDot podcast. Until next time, keep spreading the love and the care.